Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and I'm joined in the studio this morning by David King, the president and CEO of Alexander Haas, and Patrick Scullin, the founder and chief creative officer of Ames, Scullin, and O'Hare. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Patrick, we're going to start with you. Tell us a little bit about your firm and how you started it.
Well, our firm just began our 18th year.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We began in January of 1997. My two partners are John Ames, who was with Ogilvy & Mather, which is a large global advertising company that had an Atlanta office. He and Tony O'Hare, who was the media director of Ogilvy & Mather, broke off, I believe, in December of 96 and started an agency. I had my own little independent creative writing services marketing company. I read about these two guys, an account guy and a media guy, opening up an agency, and I said, something's missing here. I called them up. We met. I showed them my work. And as fate would have it, we had very similar business philosophies. We were tired of working for large, globally profit-driven, only to feed the machine agency networks. And what we really liked doing was working directly with clients on marketing problems and coming up with ideas that would build business. So the three of us banded together and started with nothing. Except dreams. I brought in a card table from home, and that was my desk. And we had some remnant office space in a building that was being rehabbed. So when we made phone calls, we always had to shield the noise of jackhammers in the background.
I guess there was probably a stray coffee pot in there somewhere.
We didn't even have a coffee pot. We had to go to the service station down the road and get bad gas station coffee. But it really was bootstrap entrepreneurship. But we had impressive backgrounds because we were all expatriates of working on large blue-chip brands like American Express, McDonald's, Anheuser-Busch, Mirage Hotel and Casino. We had credentials.
Yeah,
it wasn't
sure.
Like we were starting fresh out of college.
And now fast forward to today, 18 years later, you've grown into a very strong firm here in the city, but you do nationwide work now.
Right. We 17 years ago, one of our very first accounts was Mitsubishi Electric Air Conditioning Division. And we have had that business 17 consecutive years. Every one of those years have set record sales. And what started off as strictly a trade account has grown into a consumer-based, television, web-based, social, all aspects of communications. And that went from one of our smallest accounts in the beginning to now our largest account, which is a national piece of business. We also handle the advertising for Georgia Aquarium. We have two brands out of the Coca-Cola company, Seagram's non-alcoholic soft drinks, so that would be ginger ale, tonic water, club soda. And on the basis of the work we've done on that, we were recently awarded the Mellow Yellow account.
Fantastic. That's great.
Right.
So that Seagram's is a good example of a brand that is incredibly well known, and I guess you were brought in to effectively re-energize it and kind of do something different. Talk about that process, either with Seagram's or some other company that you've represented.
Well, Seagram's is a great example of Coca-Cola wanting to reposition the brand to take Seagram's and let that be the adult soft drink.
Okay.
Which is a very smart strategy because every other soft drink really is going for younger demographics and wants to be for everyone. Our initial campaign for them came up with the theme line, It's Good to Be You. And that theme line really resonated in the marketplace. If you look at most advertising to adults, it's always somewhat wistful. People thinking about the past, longing for the past. This was a campaign that said, no, don't do that. Celebrate where you are today, the successes you've achieved. And when you're in that moment, it's good to be you. Celebrate it with a Seagram's ginger ale.
Now, as you at your firm, I'm going to just say ASO for, is that
yes,
okay?
That's great. That's great.
makes it a little bit easier. But you talk about putting you and yours together. It's kind of your one of your taglines, I guess. What does that mean for your clients?
Well, when our agency began, our logo was draw a circle and put it into quadrants. Mm-hmm. There were four slices. Ames was in one, Scullin was in another, O'Hare, and the fourth quadrant was you. And that was our commitment to, we really want to work directly with clients. And with strategy, creative, and media engagement, those were the basic components of what advertising was when we began in 1997. Since then, a phenomenon called the internet came, and advertising became much more of a two-way dialogue because now there was social media. Now there were all sorts of digital ways for people to stay in touch and channels of communication. So we changed our logo. Ames, Scullin, O'Hare, you is now yours. And our positioning is we put people together with brands and brands together with people.
Okay, so this is kind of one, you've touched on one of the things. 25 years ago or so, 18 years ago when you started, advertising was advertising and marketing was marketing. Now we have this, the influx of digital, the influx of social. It's gotten more complicated, but I guess in some ways there's a simplicity to a beautiful message too. How do you kind of connect the complexity of the delivery mediums with, you know, a core branding message?
Well, that is the great question.
That's the magic, right?
That's the magic, and that frankly is where my advice to any business owner or anybody who's engaged in any sort of marketing activity is you really need to work with somebody who knows the ropes and can look at your business objectively and help you decide which are the best ways of reaching people and what those messages should be. Mm-hmm. Just because you can reach someone doesn't mean you should. And it doesn't mean that you should try a message that falls flat or, in fact, offends people. There's plenty of advertising today that will just upset people more than engage them.
Or sometimes you'll enjoy, it'll be entertaining, but you won't remember what the anything about it or who the message is even for.
Exactly, and that's a big problem, I think, with communications in general, is what is our job? And for a lot of people, they think it's enough to just entertain people. But if it's not relevant, if you're not making a point, if you're not getting across the consumer message, a reason why somebody should care, you're missing the mark. Mm-hmm. And as a business owner and as a creative person, first and foremost, my job is to make those connections with human beings. And after a while, it really is, it's really less about marketing and more about psychology.
So that's an interesting lead into my next question. So many of us don't every day kind of deal with the creative aspect of our beings. Bring us inside the creative process a little bit for you and your team, and get any tips or ideas about how we can all be more creative.
Well, I think the most important thing is to first think about who you're trying to reach. The best thing to do is analyze who currently is doing business with you. Mm-hmm. Ask some questions. Why? What do they like about you? What don't they like about you? If you lose business, why did they go somewhere else? What was appealing to them? Really, really study and understand what is motivating people, what you're offering that is important to people and beneficial to people, and focus on that first and foremost. Learn as much as possible. And then I think you need to be aware of societal trends of, all right, what are people doing? What are they interested in? Is there some pop culture phenomenon that you can take a hold of, you know, an interest? If you look at what happens today, things like last week, the dress. Is the dress white and gold?
Right.
It becomes a big internet meme out of nowhere. And things like that just happen. But I saw Fiat capitalized on that. They ran a print ad with a black and a blue Fiat, and it said, also available in white and gold. Now, that was smart.
Yeah,
sure. They took advantage of that. So I think as much as anything, as a business person, you have to know who you're doing business with and who you want to do business with, and why should that person want to do business with you? What are you offering that is going to be motivating and engaging?
Yeah, and I guess that's a challenge for everyone these days, is sometimes messaging is so transient, or it's like a vapor versus creating something that's lasting. And what have been some of the what's a way that you can kind of build foundations to your message rather than having it just be a kind of mist?
Well, I think you have to figure out there's that balance of the science of studying human behavior and the art of how you're reaching people. How are you triggering emotions? Mm-hmm. Because let's face it, we all like to be rational beings, but the fact of the matter is most of us spend our money to satisfy an emotion. Then we use our rational brain to justify the purchases we've made.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you really have to have an understanding of people and what is connecting to them and what's magical about them. For example, one of our clients is Georgia Aquarium. Georgia Aquarium, of course, opened to great fanfare, phenomenal success, the world's largest aquarium. They were looking for a new advertising agency, and they cast a wide net, and we were one
so
of
to
the,
speak.
Yeah, so to speak. We were one of the agencies selected, and Bernie Marcus, the founder of Home Depot and the man who, you know, had the dream of Georgia Aquarium, he and Steve Coonan, who at the time was the head of Turner Networks, they saw our presentation and our idea, which was based on a simple insight that we had. We went and talked to mothers who had taken their children to Georgia Aquarium about what the experience was like. What they told us was the kids loved the Georgia Aquarium, but what I really remember was the drive home and how much they talked about what they saw and how it stuck with them for weeks after. If they saw a whale shark on TV, they remembered that was at the Georgia Aquarium. So we presented a campaign with the positioning line, "Where Imaginations Go to Play." And it was all about how when you go to Georgia Aquarium, it's not unlike going to Disney. It is a magical experience. And you as a parent, you love the fact that you're sharing this lifetime experience with your child.
That's an incredible example of kind of connecting an event with the emotion and then creating a lasting impact or image. That's really neat.
Right, and that magic is really what we're selling, because we've all been to aquariums. The worst thing we could do is have people think that Georgia Aquarium is just another aquarium.
Right.
It really does, and it really is a magical place.
Patrick, that's a really incredible insight into ASO and your process. Thank you. I'm going to switch to David. Good morning, and ask you to just describe Alexander Haas and what you do for your clients.
Sure. Alexander Haas is a fundraising consulting company. So all of our clients are nonprofit organizations. Currently, they're spread across about 30 states, from Maine to San Diego, which is about as far as you can go.
Okay.
And, you know, without hitting water, you go too far either direction after that, you have to swim. The firm was started in 1987. Actually, a group of people got together. And sort of the genesis was that at that time, there really wasn't a significant fundraising consulting firm headquartered in the southern United States. Most of the firms that were of any significant size were either out of New York or Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt like, being, I guess, sort of proud Southerners in a sense, that we didn't need New York and Chicago to do what we needed to do. So we wanted to form a firm that would have a regional strength and begin to give nonprofit organizations in the southern United States a real viable option that was, you know, talked like them,
mm-hmm.
you know, had the same experiences and backgrounds as they did. So that was the beginning of it. And we've now sort of taken that national, obviously, with the Maine to San Diego connection. A lot of the work is with higher education institutions. About 40% of our work in any given year is with higher education and independent schools. About another 30 to 40% is with museum and cultural organizations.
Okay.
And then a little bit of everything else makes up the last piece. So churches, some hospitals, human service organizations. You know, if it can get a 501c3, we've probably worked with something like it.
And you've worked with smaller fundraising efforts, but also billion-plus-dollar efforts as well. Is there a certain area in that you specialize in, or?
Well, there are only a certain number of organizations that can do a billion-dollar-plus campaign.
Right.
So that market, I don't want to say it's a niche market, but it's pretty close.
Sure.
You know, we say this jokingly sometimes to clients, but the difference between $1 million campaign and $1 billion campaign is just commas and zeros. You know, the truth of the matter is often we find a campaign for $1 or $2 million is actually more difficult to pull off than a campaign for $1 billion. Because if you have the wherewithal to even think about executing a $1 billion campaign, it means you have a wealth of prospective donors who have resources, who are connected to you. And it's not so much a question of will they give, but how much will they give,
mm-hmm.
commas and zeros. With a smaller campaign, you generally have a smaller constituency. The number of donors who can make the kind of gift that's really going to move the needle on that is smaller than the ones that you're connected to. And your margin for error is pretty thin.
Mm-hmm.
You may have one donor who can make the top gift that you need in that kind of campaign. And if you swing and miss, the campaign's over. With a $1 billion campaign, you usually have some ways to make it up on the back end.
So talk a little bit about how your consultants work and the process that you go through with these institutions as they're contemplating a big fundraising effort and then through execution.
Well, I mean, it's probably not a whole lot dissimilar from the advertising world in a sense, in that our approach is really that no two organizations, no matter how similar they may look on the surface, are exactly alike in terms of their history, of their experience, of their fundraising experience, of the demographic of their donor base, and that for us, if there was just one magic plan that worked for every organization, we'd just write it down and sell it on Amazon and sleep in our own bed every night. But
right.
It's really not that simple. So our philosophy is that you can't give somebody direction on how to get somewhere where they want to go until you know exactly where they're standing, no matter how good the map is that you're holding in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know the starting point, you can't get to the ending point. And that our job is to really come in and first really understand that organization. So that we can then map out a plan that's very specific to getting them to their endpoint. And, you know, we talked about the impulse to purchase being an emotional decision. The impulse to give away money, I think, is even more emotional. I mean,
right.
That's really what drives it. Giving away your possessions is not a characteristic that most human beings are born with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't believe me, there's a daycare center in the bottom of this building. Go take one Tonka toy down there and hand it to 5-3-year-old boys and watch what happens.
Right.
You know, giving away your stuff just isn't inherent. So there's a real emotional thing that has to happen there. And we believe, and most of the research indicates, that that is largely driven around impacting people's lives in a positive way. Whether we're talking about an art museum or a college and university or an independent school or an organization that teaches adult literacy, the donors want to change the lives of those people. So I mean, we do a lot of campaigns that are about building buildings, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about the buildings, mm-hmm. what the facade's going to look like, what the paint colors are. You know, we get a little bit into floor plans, but the reason people give to build buildings for nonprofits is for what's going to happen inside the walls. It's not about the walls.
Right.
And so we have to be able to tap into that emotional context and show people how their gift, whatever size it may be, is going to change somebody else's life in a positive way.
Yeah, I guess the banner that seems that you guys seem to use is transforming institutions that transform lives.
Right.
And, you know, you've kind of described that beautifully as to, you know, what you're really doing on an everyday basis is working with these institutions to make them better.
Right. And we spent a fair amount of time thinking through that tagline. It wasn't accidental that we came on that instead of something like raising the most money possible every
right.
day. because sometimes what happens with what we do is that transforming the institution becomes something different than what we were hired to do.
Mm-hmm.
We may have been hired to do a feasibility study about a $10 million campaign, and when we get in there, we find a situation that's really holding this organization back from doing that or doing some other good work. Maybe it's a dysfunctional board. Maybe it's a staff organization that's just not working. Maybe it's the way that they've distanced themselves from their donor constituency. And that we have to go in there before we can help them raise a lot of money and transform the institution
mm-hmm.
so that they're ready to do that. So it's, you know, I guess maybe it's a good marketing line because it can be interpreted a lot of different ways. But on the one hand, we sometimes transform organizations by raising millions and millions of dollars for them to do things. And sometimes we transform organizations more from the inside out to mm-hmm. help them be better. So that's, we sort of landed on that because our outcome in transformation is not always raising money, even though that's usually what we're hired to do. Sometimes the work takes us and the organization in a different direction first.
You know, so often there's the leader of the not-for-profit, but then there's also the board of directors or trustees. How do you typically interact with boards and, you know, what have been some of the key learnings that you have from interacting with so many over the years?
The level of board engagement for us is a key indicator of how successful the organization can possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't think any organization can really rise above the level of its own board makeup. So if you come into an organization with a really disengaged board,
reality to the situation, sometimes it's not, as you say, about raising the money. Sometimes it's about, hey, you may need to do some work before you can even launch a project.
Absolutely. We did a project with a hospital, a children's hospital, once, and we went out and did a feasibility study. I don't remember. Maybe they wanted to raise $50 million. And there on their letterhead, this board was a who's who of the wealthy and powerful people in that community. So we went out and we did this feasibility study. We interviewed a bunch of those people about the proposed campaign. We interviewed a lot of other philanthropists. And essentially, the feedback we got was, well, when I look at this board list, you ought to be able to get half of this from your own board. And when you looked at the board list, that looked very feasible. And when we went back to talk to our client about it, they said, oh, well, that'll never happen because these people, they're really just names on the letterhead. They're not really engaged mm-hmm. here. And so our message was, well, then you're dead in the water, essentially, because the rest of the community is expecting to see this board lead because it is a board of leaders.
Right.
But you've not set it up to be able to do that. So we're going to have to untie some knots here and reset the expectations of this board before you're going to be able to do anything significant with this. So while they had what on paper looked like a good board, it wasn't functioning like a good board, and that was holding them back.
Interesting. Talk about the state of philanthropy these days. You know, we've had a tough recession/depression, and it seems like things are improving, but this is one of those key economic indicators, really, is how is this is is the health of philanthropy. Yeah. I'd love your perspective on it.
Philanthropy trails a lot of other things in the marketplace, in the economic marketplace, but it's recovering. It is not, overall, philanthropy hasn't reached where it was at the end of 2008, which was the all-time high. I think it was $315 billion at that point. Although some of the subsectors have recovered past where they were in 2008, higher education or giving to education, for example, last year was at its highest point ever. But we're seeing some other sectors that aren't recovering quite as fast. Giving to religion is really, although in terms of dollars, it's still one of the largest subsectors. In terms of percentage of total giving, it's actually dropping pretty rapidly.
Hmm.
In fact, in 1987, giving to religion was 55% of all giving. Last year, it was 30%.
Wow, so that's incredible.
To put it back into our branding and marketing terms, it's losing market share at a pretty dramatic rate, and we're starting to see that now translate into the dollars beginning to decline. So it's not, you know, not all subsectors participated equally in the recession. Human services, for example, didn't really go down during the recession because a lot of donors looked around, said, we've got people unemployed, we've got people in need, we need to move some of our philanthropy to human services. But you saw things like arts and cultural organizations and environment and animal welfare really get hit hard in the recession.
Mm.
Those two subsectors have come back since. But it's healthy and it's growing, and we're, you know, it's not exponential growth. We're looking at growth the last couple years on the scale of 3-4% a year. We're projecting growth the next couple years, 4.5-5% a year. So mm-hmm. we're not, you know, it's a nice gentle hike. We're not climbing Mount Everest here,
right.
But it's moving in the right direction.
That's great. David, talk about some of the cultural cornerstones of your firm. And, you know, you're in the professional services business ultimately, and your people walk out the door every day. Right. What's some of the keys to your success?
Well, I think one of them is in the recruitment process to begin with, to look for people. There are a lot of people out there who have extensive backgrounds in fundraising and could possibly be good consultants, although the skill sets between being a good fundraiser and being a good consultant are somewhat different, but they have the mm-hmm. experience to do it. So what we really look for is somebody who's going to come in and be able to fit into the culture of the firm so that all of our clients are having the same firm experience.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty big on brand experience, and we want everybody to experience us the same way. So a part of that is that we're a very hands-on firm. We don't like to come into a client once a month and tell them what they did wrong. We want to be consulted in real time and giving advice that's shaping decisions. You know, we'd rather keep the car out of the ditch than pull it out of the ditch. So there's a piece of that. We want people who are very much into hand-holding. And the other piece that we really try to keep focused on at all times is we have to give the client the advice that we believe in our minds and in our hearts is the best course of action for them, whether they want to hear it or not, and whether it's good for us or not. So we'll recommend people don't have a campaign. Take 2 years and do some groundwork before you start a campaign. Bad decision for us. You know, it ends our relationship often and leads to not moving into ongoing work. But it's what has to happen for the organization to be successful. And our experience is that when we do that, when we put the client's needs, when we just completely forget about what's in our best interest and only do what's right for the client, that universally it comes back to benefit us in ways we might not have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
It may be years down the road, but in terms of a reference or a recommendation or a client coming back and saying, we're not even talking to anybody else this time around because you were so honest and forthright with us and got us on the right track that we just trust you. We're just going to hire you.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, that's one of the hallmarks, I think, of the firm is that we're really not as much focused on things like billing and hours and things like that, where a lot of service firms get bogged down. And more focused on outcome for the client, and that if we keep our eye on that, the long-term benefit for the firm will be greater than what the short-term sacrifice is.
Patrick, you talked about outcome of the client as well. Other cultural cornerstones of ASO that are really important for your firm?
We like to hire the smartest, most curious people we can find. We think that it's absolutely critical that if you're going to be in this business that you have a curiosity about people And I think the most important consideration for success in this business is empathy, that ability to sit with somebody, listen to them, think about what they're saying, ask the questions, but that's how you're going to make a human connection. And if you don't have, if you're not going to be empathetic, chances are you're not going to be successful. So that's the critical thing for us. We want people, we have our own code of conduct with 8 keys for success, and we have those posters with summations of it lining our wall, and the document itself we show to everyone when we're interviewing them, because when we hire them, they will sign it, we will sign it, and we will all live by it.
That's an incredible unifying thing when you have that visible, even in the interview process, because what I found is that people actually will self-select out if they don't really feel comfortable with your culture.
Absolutely, and the other thing is they also understand that when it comes time for performance review, this is our cheat sheet. Mm-hmm. That is how you are graded on all 8 of those criteria. So it's very important, we think, to keeping that culture of an understanding. And I think part of that was we as partners had worked at a number of different ad agencies, and all too often a business will have a mission statement, which is some high, lofty goal of 8, 10, 12 words that is a goal, but there's nothing actionable about that. Your perception of what that means is different from Dave's, is different from mine. So really felt that it was important that there be a unified code of behavior.
Mm-hmm. You both work in team environments. How do you ensure the continuous improvement of your teams as the leader of the firm?
That's that is...
I'm anxious to hear your answer.
Well... My answer is I preach it all of the time that if you can, always give information face to face. If you can't do that, do it over the phone. If you can't do that, do it by email. But as much as possible, we want people to collaborate together as opposed to sitting at your computer and fielding emails and managing by email. And I think that's a challenge for all businesses. Again, going back to just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something.
Right.
And getting back to that point about empathy, you communicate so much better 1-to-1 or 1-to-4. And that exchange of ideas and collaboration is where the magic happens.
Yeah, it's a little bit different when you're communicating via email. There's just not as many good ideas that come out of that.
No.
It's you know, my idea speaking to your idea and back and forth. There's really no collaboration there, right?
It's like playing tennis. Mm-hmm. You're returning a volley. You're serving. It's not the best way to do it. Now, it's one thing if you have to do that because you're out of town or clients are out of town. But even then, I think a phone call is a much better way of communicating. But if that's possible, yes, email, text, sharing the information somehow is better than nothing.
Right.
But we're always encouraging the human interaction.
David, ideas on improving your team?
Well, we do work in teams on everything that we do, and I think some of that starts at the very beginning from the seats that Patrick and I sit in and configuring the teams to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
If I have people who I know don't work in a compatible way, they may like each other fine, but they just don't work in the same way and it creates problems, then to the extent that I can, I'll try not to team them up in a way that's going to be problematic. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes the client needs to take that out of my control. You know, they've got 2 skill sets here that I have to put together to make this work, and in which case that becomes more challenging. But communication is the key to it after the team is put together. And in our case, it's pretty difficult. I agree, face-to-face is always better, and you know, the hierarchy that we use for soliciting donors follows that too. Face-to-face is better. Mm-hmm. You can read body language. You can communicate in a completely different way. But with, you know, with our clients where they are, and I have people, most of our people live here in Atlanta, but I also have consultants who live in New York City, Norfolk, Virginia, Dallas, Texas. So they have to be communicating all the time, but it's planes, trains, and automobiles for us a lot of the time because a lot of what we deliver is done face-to-face. Mm-hmm. So email ends up becoming a big tool for that. A lot of emails flying at 30,000 feet these days now that GoGo InFlight lets us work, you know, all the time. But I think for our group, it works partially because of the selection process of who we hire. I mean, we're trying to hire people who already have a shared value. We all come from a similar background. Everybody we've hired has spent most, if not all, of their career working in the nonprofit sector as a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. So they have that shared experience. And if they have the shared experience and the shared background, and we all are coming at it from the perspective that we have to do what's best for the client, then it's just a matter of keeping everybody in the loop and keeping focused on who's driving the ship, who's a passenger in the ship, you know, and who's maybe the anchor holding the ship back and getting all those things working together.
Well, both of you are so, you know, kind of in process on vision and branding. What suggestions would you have to business owners out there who either have an issue with their brand that they have to address, or if they just feel like they're not getting the power out of their brand message that they perhaps otherwise would? Advice on, other than perhaps calling one of you to help them out, because that's obvious, you know, going to, and maybe that's part of the answer is sometimes you really need outside help to really do that.
Yeah, we don't do a lot of branding work per se. I mean, we would typically, if we find part of our work is to figure out what an organization's reputation and brand is, because if it's not good, we can't raise money around it. But if it's not good and they need to change it, we'll try to find somebody like Patrick's firm who can go in and work with them on brand. But I think the thing that people don't understand about brand is that you can attempt to shape it, but you got to find out what it is first.
Right.
And
right.
You are not determining what it is. The marketplace has set what your brand is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want it to be something different, you first have to find out what it is and then figure out how you begin to shape people's opinion differently. But you don't necessarily just get to set it and say, oh, we're brand, you know, X, because the market's going to brand you what they experience you to be.
Right.
That's true. And I think as a business owner, you also have to look inward. And is there something in your gut that is telling you you're not doing it right? And why? Why isn't that happening? Are you selecting the wrong people? Are you not communicating clearly? Do they not understand? Something's out of alignment if you feel like I've got a branding issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you're an entrepreneur, you've got to go back to your roots. Why did you decide you wanted to be in business in the first place? What was your initial offering, and is that offering still relevant today?
Yeah, and so really kind of going back to that core business issue and then building from there or figuring out what the market's saying and drive it.
What's the business offering? When we started, the biggest lesson I learned is there's only one role for starting a business, and that's find someone to write you checks and you're in business. It's that complex and it's that simple. But you have to determine what are you doing that is worth money, that is valuable to someone else.
One of our previous guests said his best business advice was, nothing happens until the sale occurs.
And, that's true.
You know, there is an element of that. Speaking of best business advice, David, what's the best business advice you've ever received?
I think the best advice that I received that really sort of shaped how we go about doing what we do was a piece of advice that you will never accumulate significant wealth billing your own time. That time is a limited thing that you really can't control, and that if you're planning to support yourself by just billing your own hours, you'll survive, but you won't accumulate, you won't build a business probably, and you won't build any significant wealth. That you have to find a way to sell value rather than time, and that you have to be able to communicate that to your customers, that it's not, I'm not working at McDonald's. This is not a $10 an hour gig. I've been in this business for 30 years. I know things. You're buying what I know, not the 2 minutes it took me to tell it to you.
So you're unlike many other consultancy firms, maybe outside of fundraising, but who typically bill by the hour.
A lot of fundraising firms do bill by the hour or bill a retainer and apply hours to it. Our philosophy is very different on that, and some of it goes to that piece of advice, and I've had that reinforced as I've read. I'm a business book reading kind of guy, as I've read other business books about professional service firms and sort of the trap of getting stuck billing your days or your hours, and how limiting that can be, and how stressful it can be on your staff, and how it can create friction between you and the client. You're a little bit at odds. I'm trying to bill you hours. You're trying to keep me from billing you hours, but to do my job, I got to bill you hours.
Right.
So it's built in a little bit, you know, to the culture, which is we're going to bill a flat fee and we're going to do everything you need us to do to make you successful for that flat fee. You know, it's on us to do it efficiently. It's on us to set that fee at the right place to begin with. But that we do not want our clients sitting behind their desk thinking, should I call David and ask him to come to this board meeting this week? I really hate to do that. It's going to cost $2,500 for the day, plus, you know, to have him come down here.
Right.
I want the client thinking, David's got all of our board meetings on his calendars for the next 2 years, and he's going to be here to support us, whether we need him or not. And so that we want our clients to think of us as we're on the team. We're not, you know, an arm's length extra expense, but we're part of their core team, and we want them looking for ways to get us more involved in what they're doing rather than less.
Great. Patrick,
it's a great point, and I'm glad to hear you say that, Dave, because as an ad agency, we're one of the few, we do not keep timesheets.
Neither do we.
the exact same philosophy. That what we're hired for is our ideas and our thinking. And when we engage with a professional relationship, we look at the scope of work. And we have to guesstimate what we think it's going to cost. But I don't want to spend my time trying to remember what I did that day. And I can tell you, as a creative person who worked at a lot of different agencies, sometimes the most creative writing people do is their timesheet.
Mm-hmm.
And the creative process is not, it's not that linear of a profession. There was a famous composer who was, I think it was Bach, who was asked, how did you come up with that beautiful sonata? And he said, well, I was lying by the stream one day and that darn tune just popped into my head. So,
well, the other issue that you get with that, with the time, is I'll go to sleep with the client problem in my head and wake up in the morning with what I think is the perfect solution.
So you bill your
Do
I bill 8 hours for that?
You
know,
right.
Do I go to work and think about it some more for 8 hours so I can bill it? You know, I mean, a lot of stuff happens when you're truly invested in your client's success. You're thinking about them all the time,
right? And you're in it together.
We talked about long car rides today, and you know. Windshield time is often some of the best problem-solving time that I get because I'm just sort of, you know, the brain is free from interruption and everything else. And,
right.
And you know, I come up with good ideas and bad ideas, but I come up with ideas.
Right.
So Patrick, is your best business advice to lay by the stream every once in a while?
that's pretty good advice. I think the best business advice I received when we first started, a friend of mine who'd been an entrepreneur for a number of years, just gave the great advice of don't think too far ahead. Just every day, remember why you're in business and what you're offering, mm-hmm. and what you're offering is a service. You're offering solutions to someone who has problems, and keep the focus short. So it's more of a tortoise hair sort of a strategy. Don't get too far ahead of yourself. Just concentrate on what it is you're doing, and don't lift your head up and get distracted, because it's easily enough to get distracted.
Great.
And lose your focus.
Thank you. That's both great advice for everyone. We're going to move quickly into the speed round. I'm going to ask you a few random questions here. David, favorite business book? You mentioned you're a big reader.
My favorite business book, and one that I've given a lot of copies away to people, is a book called E-Myth, which is, I forget the subtitle, but it's basically an entrepreneur's guide to starting a business. And what I love about it is the philosophy is when you start your business, shape it for what you want it to be in the future, not for what it is now. So one of the sort of key components of it is build out the full organization chart for what you see this looking like in 5 years. And right now your name's probably going to be in every box.
Right.
But then your job as an entrepreneur is to get your name out of boxes and get other people's names in those boxes. And I think, what I think is helpful for that is a lot of people who are starting business or in a business and trying to grow it are so in the moment of doing it that thinking strategically about growing it is hard to do. But if you've already got it, here's what it's going to look like, and that's what I'm trying to make happen, the strategy is sort of there. Then it becomes tactical.
Right.
But so I found that to be very helpful, because I don't think most people think about it that way. Set it up for the way you want it to look in the future rather than what you have the resources to do at the moment.
Great. Patrick, what'd you want to be when you were growing up?
Write. Be a writer.
When did you know that?
Probably sophomore year of high school. I had a high school teacher who exposed us to Richard Brautigan poetry and Harry Chapin music. I just thought that the expression, freedom of expression, really appealed to me. And then I started doing research as to what sort of careers and money writers made. I come from a large family and always had a capitalistic bent. And what I found out was the few famous people make very good livings, but there's a lot of people in the arts who do not make much money. They do it for the passion. So then I did research, and I found out that advertising copywriters, if you were good at it, you could make some very good living. So I pursued that track.
That's great. David, what about favorite charity or organization? I know that I'm kind of asking.
Yeah,
the,
I'm really going to have to take a pass on that.
one that you're personally invested in that you work with.
I don't want to narrow it down to one because I think that's an occupational hazard for me particularly. But one thing that my wife and I and increasingly our children are passionate about is children. Mm-hmm. And my wife's very involved with Children's Healthcare of Atlanta and sick children. But we're also very concerned about homelessness and child trafficking and just poverty and lack of opportunities for a lot of kids in the society that we're growing up in now. Mm-hmm. There's a huge homeless teen population in Atlanta that's basically invisible to most people. Mm. I've worked with advocates in this area who said, if you walk through the food court at Lenox Mall, about half the kids you'll see in there under the age of 18 are homeless on any given day. But they're doing everything they can to blend in, because the worst thing that can happen to you as a homeless kid is to get sucked into the system. Mm. And so they feel that they have better opportunity on the street than they do, in the system. So that's something that we're passionate about. There are a number of organizations that we support or are involved with around that issue, but mm-hmm. it's something that we, have sort of found kind of by accident that the whole family's gotten involved in.
That's great. Patrick, favorite organizations or institutions that you...
We we donate our time and talent to the Georgia Council of Nonprofits, and we helped them a couple years ago establish Georgia Gives Day. And what that was and is raising as much money as possible in a 24-hour period for nonprofits across the state. So it's very easy. You go to one website, you pick the cause that's most important to you, and you can make a tax deductible donation right then and there. And the first year we did it for Georgia Gives Day, they raised $750,000. Which was
great.
And does
it continue today?
It continues today. Last year, I believe it was $2.4 million.
Fantastic.
So it just is growing and growing and growing, and we'll be working with them again this year. And it's as much as anything, I think it's an awareness issue. As more and more people become familiar with the concept that Georgia Gives, on one day I can make this donation, we make it as easy as possible. It's a great cause, and we take great pride in that.
What is the day
this year? This year, I believe it's December 13th. I'll have to double check.
Okay. Well, we'll check on that. Get the word out on that.
Right.
That's great.
Well, you know, I said before that I didn't think giving away your stuff is inherent, and Georgia Gives Day is an example of trying to teach people philanthropic behavior.
Absolutely.
And part of what we like about it, from someone who works in the sector all the time, is if you can teach people to be philanthropic once, the likelihood of them continuing to be philanthropic and expanding that really goes up exponentially.
Right. You're changing their behavior, and then potentially it becomes a habit.
Well, right. It feels good.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's an emotional act, giving money to help somebody. So you give it away, you get a little, shot of endorphin, and you feel good about it, and you want to do it again. We'd like people to get addicted to philanthropy.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there are so many people and so many causes in need that it's really important.
Absolutely. Thank you both for joining us in the studio. This has been great. David, how can our listeners learn more about your firm or contact you?
We're easy to find. Our website is www.fundraisingcouncil.com. And even if you misspell council, we've got that URL too. So we're easy to track down.
Great. Thank you, Patrick.
Our website is asoy.com, asoy.com, and people always ask, all right, if the agency's ASO, why the Y? Well, but going back to our logo, Aim, Skull, and O'Hare, you. So asoy.com, and there, once you're there, you'll see some of the work we've done for Mitsubishi Electric, Golf Pride, Golf Grips, Seagram's, UPS, Cox Communications, and five different banners of Dale Hayes America grocery stores.
Yeah, you both have incredible websites, and it's really it draws you in and really describes your firm beautifully. Thank you both again. This has been a lot of fun. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast, sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.